Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez.
And I'm Daniel Chacon.
And this is Words on a Wire, our new season coming up here between the 2019 and 2020 season. We have a lot of good things lined up for you, but we're happy to be back with you all. And hopefully you've missed us as much as we've missed you.
Absolutely. I thought about you all summer.
Oh, yeah. Is that right? Nice. Very
the
nice.
Collective you.
The collective you. Yes. Well, we're actually going to be focusing today's conversation on kind of a just a more maybe – if we're capable of it, a more serious tone. Of course, we'll have some comedy relief in there because that's just what we do, a little bit of shenanigans here and there. But no, we actually wanted to respond. Words on a Wire wants to respond to what took place here in El Paso a few weeks ago, the shooting that took place at Walmart that is known now, obviously, across the nation and beyond, unfortunately. But, you know, we wanted to respond to that. We felt like, you know, here as two authors who are engaged in the community and who have a platform, we just thought it'd be kind of an interesting and probably a very vital conversation to have as part of this community. But we also wanted to open it up a little bit, not just talk about sort of our own personal perspectives on this, because I know that I have some personal experience that was – you know, I think it's always reignited whenever I hear that there are these types of tragedies that take place across the country, whether it's mass shootings or whether it's even, you know, a police force or a cop, you know, committing some kind of act of violence on an individual. Any of these things are always kind of triggering for me, and they take me back to my own personal experiences. But then I have to give it some time and reflect a little bit as an artist, as an author, and how this might, you know, what of my work do I feel is informed by that, and what responsibility do I have to the community? And I know, being in conversation with you, Daniel, we've talked about that quite a bit, and so I know that that's one of the things that we that's what we want to talk about today is a little bit of that and open it up to the conversation. But Daniel,
you know,
go ahead.
You mentioned about you know how this what happened on August 3rd, mm-hmm. the morning of August 3rd was you know known all around the world. I have WhatsApp on my phone. Because I travel a lot internationally, and a lot of the people we interact with in our department, because it's bilingual, are from Latin America. And so it's easy to send texts via WhatsApp. And I probably got 10 WhatsApp messages all the way from Poland, from Argentina, from all over the world, asking if I was okay.
Right.
You know, on the day it happened.
Well, in fact, okay, so let's start there. That's kind of what I wanted to ask you first. I wanted to just kind of just ask you, you know, where were you? Can you take us back to the moment when you found out about this tragedy?
Well, I was extremely hungover. You told them there'd be humor. No, I'm kidding. I remember that morning I had to go to Sam's, you know, and as you know, Sam's is right next to Walmart.
Yeah.
But we have a Sam's on our side of town.
So the west side of El Paso.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And there's another one right next to the Walmart where the shooting happened. And I went there to get baby formula because we buy it in bulk. Our baby eats a lot. And but they didn't have it. They quit carrying the kind that we got, which meant we had to go to regular stores where it's just ridiculously priced.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, well, I'm just going to run down to the other Sam's very quickly, you know, which is right next to that Walmart.
Right.
But I thought, no, I'll just go home first because maybe Jolene will want to go with me. So I went home first. And then, you know, we were just lying around. She was, you know, in the process of getting up, you know, how it could take, you know, some time to just on a Saturday. Right.
Right.
And she got a text from her aunt saying, don't go to Walmart. And her aunt, this was way before the media got even knew about it, because her aunt is married to a police officer that was sent there.
Right.
And she said, there's an active shooter. And we didn't really know what that meant. So we checked all the media, social media. There was nothing, absolutely nothing.
Right.
And then it started to come out little by little, first on social media before the news outlets were able to report about it. So she told me, start texting your friends and tell them not to go there. So I texted my friends and said, don't go to Walmart. And
even I didn't get a text from you.
Yes, because you were in Mexico, deep into Mexico.
Well, I didn't get a text from you. I see. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
And then we just sat around and, you know, kept checking our devices until, you know, we found so many, you know, multiple sources until the full picture came. And but one of the things that really struck me and kind of made me angry is that the initial official media, there's a difference between social media and official media,
right.
Because if there's a certain amount of people dead and that information is out, it'll appear on social media first because, quote, legitimate journalism has to verify facts before they say it. And so, but the legitimate media was able to say that it seems like it's gang-related.
Oh, I never even
gang-related. And, you know, if you're from El Paso, you know that's bull crap.
Yeah.
There's not going to be gangs in El Paso that are going to go into a Walmart and start shooting it up.
Right.
This isn't Fresno.
that's true.
where I'm from.
Yeah,
no offense, Fresno.
Well, that's
I love you, man.
Too, so, yeah.
But, you know, I knew it was wrong, and I sensed in my gut that it was racist.
Oh, that the
that it was
the
a racist.
Was racist.
Yeah, and of course, as things started to come out, we found that it was blatantly, undeniably racist.
Right, by the shooter's admission.
Right,
You know, there's so much that you're touching on there that you know. Hopefully, we can get to in these next 25-30 minutes that we have to talk about this. You know, for me, I was driving back from California. Mm-hmm. I had just gotten back from Mexico, where I'd been for part of the summer. And I went back to California, and I was only going to be in California for 1 week before driving with my daughter back to El Paso, because we live here, obviously.
Right.
And we went to Fresno. That's where my daughter was at, with her mother staying there. And when I landed there from Mexico, and I landed in California, a day later is when the shooting in Gilroy happened. Now, Gilroy from Fresno, as you know, is about 90 minutes, and it's just right there.
Right,
and so
absolutely.
It felt... At that point, we had this conversation about how close to home that felt. And we said, gosh, this is all happening too close to home.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few days later, my daughter and I loaded up the truck and we started to drive to El Paso. And on the drive, that's when my mother and my phone started to blow up. Folks started to text me and people were saying, are you okay? Are you okay? And I said, why? What's going on? We're driving. And then that's how I found out that this shooting had occurred. And I didn't know to the degree yet until I finally got home here in El Paso. And when I learned the degree of that, I just said, this is incredible. And my daughter looked at me and she said, it's following us, Dad.
And I
couldn't respond to that. You know, that is a real fear. You know, and I think a lot of people, I think that echoes the sentiment of a lot of folks in this country today, right? It's following us.
Right. Yeah. And the day after I was at Target.
Mm-hmm.
And because we didn't want to go to Walmart, there's a Walmart near our house. And there was something like, you know, I don't know, just... You know, some energy that obviously wanted to stay away. But we went to Target, and there was this young man that worked there that was pushing the carts together, and they went bang, and this lady jumped.
Yeah.
And it looked like she was so scared. And it passed after a while, but it wasn't a micro expression.
Yeah.
She was scared. And that's kind of how it felt walking around the whole city, which is strange because El Paso, and we hear this in the media all the time, and Donald Trump, you know, tried to, you know, say that it wasn't true, but El Paso is one of the safest cities in the world, and we're not used to that kind of fear.
No, not at all. But you know what we've become used to lately, specifically here in El Paso, is that type of sort of being under the microscope, you know? And that's something that's just kind of an interesting, I think, occurrence more recently because of the president that we have in office and because of, you know, a lot of because the media's kind of keeping it in sort of on the public radar, the conversation of immigration. So everybody can't help but point toward El Paso as being one of the main ports since the beginning of time, pretty much port of entry. But, you know, we just also back in the fall of last October, you know, we were some of us here were working on trying to get the Tornillo Children's Detention Center shut down.
Right.
So there's a lot of attention on that, a lot of attention because, you know, obviously, like you said, Trump was out here, too.
And the deplorable conditions
of how they're
keeping the migrants. And right here on Santa Fe Bridge, which is less than, what, 2 miles away from where we're sitting?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a 20-minute walk from my house. You know, it's we're right there, literally. And because I live here now, because I've only lived here for 5 years, but you know, my house is situated near UTEP, and where I can literally look out my kitchen window and see Juarez and see the whole, just see the real physical borderlands. And I contemplate that a lot about not just the kind of attention that El Paso has been receiving, but because I want to say a part of me feels like what occurred is very much related. It's an outcome of the attention,
agree.
The negative attention and also the attention that has been sort of.
In fact, you know, the connection that I would make is that when Trump came here on his rally, he said something that shocked anybody who lives in El Paso, and that is that this was the most dangerous city in the United States. I forget his exact rhetoric, but it was along the lines of this was the most dangerous city until they built a wall, and now El Paso is safe.
Yeah.
And we knew that that wasn't true, and everybody knew that wasn't true. But Trump claimed that this was the most dangerous city, and his followers made it. Or at least one of his followers, and there was actually two. There was a shooter that, well, not a shooter, but somebody who had these AK-47s
right. Yeah.
the next day to an immigrant center in El Paso, but they couldn't arrest him because it's legal to carry that ridiculous amount of guns and ammunition. But it's as if him saying it caused it to be true.
That's right.
And that's, you know, first of all, I think that's a tremendously dangerous and sad thing to think about. That
it is.
That you know that
it is. And you know, I recently had the opportunity to go walk around at the memorial site there now behind the Walmart, and that sense of fear, but also of a kind of really on edge here in the community. You know, even after 9/11, which, you know, for me, the reason why I think of 9/11 when that happened is because that was the only other time in my life where I experienced the kind of collective grieving, a collective grief of a community, that after 9/11 and the days after, if you were around and you were an adult who was able to comprehend that feeling that was in the air at that time, you've sensed there was a collective grieving. And I was in Fresno at the time, you know, thousands of miles away. But here in El Paso, that sense of collective grief took place the next few days and is even still kind of around, lingering still. But it certainly in the few days after that that happened, you felt that in the air. You know, even going to stores was just a quiet, somber kind of a situation. You know, go ahead.
You know, that's interesting because I was thinking about that parallel between 9/11 and the El Paso shooting on August 3rd, and I think that you know hundreds of thousands. I forget the exact number, so you know, don't.
Sure.
I'm not going to say, but thousands and thousands of people died in New York City that day in that building, and the nation felt that. I mean, we felt it. I remember the morning of that shooting, I mean, of that terrorist act on that 9/11 attack, I had to teach at 11 a.m., and all the news was coming out by then, and I went into the class, and I was supposed to talk about a poem that day, but I thought, how futile. Why do I want to talk about a poem? It was such an incredible impact on me as a human being, and as a writer, and as a citizen of the world. But if you look at the numbers, 23 people were killed. I think it was an additional one after that died, and so many people were injured. 9/11 to the country is this shooting at Walmart is to El Paso what 9/11 is to the country. You can't not feel it. Things have changed. Something shifted. The world has somehow changed, and we see it a little bit differently
now. Our reality has changed. That's right. And specifically, I mean, yes, collectively as a whole, after 9/11, the United States, folks, even around the world felt that. But, you know, in El Paso, certainly now, this has shifted a lot of the energy, I think.
And if you look around El Paso, no matter where you go, whether it's a business or a government entity or somebody putting a big sign on their house, you see these El Paso Strong signs, you know, where it's, you know, the community's attempt to, at least on the level of language, come together and to not forget it. And I think that's what's important. And we were talking, we want to talk about what is our responsibilities as writers to respond to this. Well, you know, I think one of the responsibilities, if you think about El Paso Strong, just putting that on a sign, linguistically connects us and causes us not to forget. And I think on some level, that's what our responsibility is as writers, to not let our community forget, to not let the United States forget, to not let the world forget what happened.
And when we say forget, at least by my interpretation as artists, as community folks, and you're right, I agree with that, El Paso Strong, that kind of tagline being a reminder to us. And when we say to not forget, I like to think that it's not just to not forget the incident or to not forget, you know, that the racism that spurred this incident on. But it's also to not forget, you know, how we as a community are strong, how we are kind, the things that we do give to one another. So it's not just a looking at it from in terms of a negative don't forget, but it's also there's positive don't forget.
Absolutely.
Don't forget who we are, who we were before this, and who will continue to be after this, you know.
Right.
And that is the power of language, El Paso Strong. You know, I was talking with my daughter about about that, because everywhere we went, and still today, everywhere you go, any store, at any part, west side, east side, wherever you go in El Paso, you know, you'll see folks everywhere, like 9 out of 10 people are wearing shirts or buttons that say El Paso Strong. Yeah. And it's I was telling my daughter, it is. It's a reminder that we are strong, that we are beautiful people, that we are kind, you know.
Right. Absolutely. That's what we remember. We can't forget this. And the other thing is that when I think about, you know, when I the day after I was contacted by some news, some media, some AP and Al Jazeera, to make statements, you know, because I'm a writer, I guess. Right. Somehow they got my name, and I didn't know what to say. You know, and I, you know, fortunately, it was easy because they asked me questions. But I really didn't know what to say, and I didn't know what I could say. I was blank because I didn't want to just speak out of anger, and I didn't want to speak out of reaction. So all I could really talk about, and even now, I haven't written about it.
That's my question. Yeah.
But if I were to write about it, and I know if I were to write about it or speak about it, all I'm going to do is end up telling stories about how much I love El Paso and why El Paso is a special place, because I deeply believe El Paso, especially for the Latino people, for the Chicano people, for the Mexican Americans, for the Mexicans, for the people in the Southwest, is such an important, magic, significant city. That's what I end up doing, telling its praises.
Singing its praises, right?
You know, which is, maybe that's a way of not forgetting, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it is, absolutely. I mean, well, let me ask, because I was going to ask you that, but since you answered it, let me ask you something else then. You know, do you feel it's the, or what responsibility, if we can use that word, do you feel writers or artists in general might have to use their platform as a way to help us not forget?
Oh, you know what? That's an excellent question. I've been thinking about Pablo Neruda, and you know, a lot could be said about the poetry of Pablo Neruda.
Sure.
And you can even, you know, do some, you know, social commentary about his misogyny and all this stuff.
Sure.
But one of the great things about this poet, other than his language, his incredible ability to just follow language and let you take it anywhere, is his political commitment, his commitment to the people, to his commitment to justice, and his poetry. He says in a poem called Explico Algunas Cosas, I explain a few things. His poetry changed when he was in Spain during the Civil War, and he saw how the army went in and killed homosexuals and killed gypsies and killed poor people. And he said his poetry could never, ever be the same. And so in this poem, Explico Algunas Cosas, he starts out by saying, and you might ask, where are the metaphysical pockets of blanket of poppies and blah, blah, blah. Why aren't you writing, you know, about mountains and all these beautiful things and fish jumping in the sea? And he says, I can't do it anymore because of what I saw in Spain, because of the unjust. And he's got this incredible line that I think is one of the most beautiful lines in poetry, rejecting metaphor, where he says the blood of the children running the streets simply like the blood of children. You know, like there was no simile that can explain it. But the way he closes the poem, and he's basically saying that.
Do you have it there with us?
The way he closes the poem to me speaks to the urgency of, you know, of the necessity of saying something. It ends, and you will ask, why doesn't his poetry speak of dreams and leaves and the great volcanoes of his native land? And here's the last stanza. Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Three times. You know, that's why I can't write poetry like I used to anymore, because of what I've seen in Spain. And in a sense, on some level, that's got to be the way this is affecting writers who are rooted here in El Paso. It's going to somehow change us, I think.
Yeah.
But
right.
I don't know.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, you know, as we were preparing a little bit to have this conversation, you know, I was thinking about, again, going back to 9/11, only because it was the only time in my life, other time in my life, where I experienced this feeling, this sense of this collective grief. And obviously it was a tragedy on a on an immense scale. But for me, I kept thinking about, I was in conversation with Bobby Bird, mm-hmm. you know, for those here in El Paso and even actually internationally know the name Bobby Bird. He's him and his wife, Lee. They founded the Cinco Puntos Press, which is based here in El Paso. And they've published writers who are well known all across the country.
A lot of Ben Sines books
are from there. Yeah, they're just great folks. And Bobby's also very spiritually minded. And so is Lee, very spiritual minded folks. And he and I were having a conversation and he said to me, you know, have you written about what happened here in El Paso a few weeks ago. And I said, Bobby, I haven't even written about 9/11 yet. I said, I'm still trying to figure that out, you know.
Right.
And now I say that because while I haven't directly written about 9/11, and I don't know if I'll ever directly write about El Paso and what occurred here, those certainly inform.
Right.
I mean, you can't help but your DNA be shifted by these incidents, right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting
it. The molecular structure of who we are gets shifted,
right.
And it's never the same. And maybe that's also the way when I hear you read Neruda and what he's talking about, that's how I feel, that the person I am is never the same.
Right.
And therefore, it does influence the shape of what I'm writing, not only what I'm writing, but also who I'm reaching in my writing.
I haven't written about it. I haven't sat down and write about it, but I do know it has affected me as a writer because before this was happening, I was intensely working on this book that I've been boring you about, telling you about for the last 5-6 years, a book on mysticism. Mm. And
Working on that?
Yeah. And I was working on it intensely, you know, and it's, you know, I'm going into all these mystic concepts, the Kabbalah tree of life and the, you know, going to the upper worlds and all this crap.
Right.
And I hear about this, and the next day I pick up one of the books that I was going deeply into, and I go, Chacon, get your head out of the clouds. Just stop it. And I felt myself pull myself out of this, you know, this metaphysical realm, which in itself recognizes some sort of thought hierarchy, you know. And so you're over here interacting with thought beings that are not of this world. And it's like, what the hell are you doing up there? You know, and I think of that line again, come and see the blood in the streets. And I didn't write about it, but I started going back to children's stories that I was writing for my daughter, Lucinda, because I can't help but to look at her face. In fact, when we were hearing about it, when we got the first text, I was holding her. Mm. She was in my arms and I was looking at her face. And as it started to develop, even before it was on media, I put a post on Facebook, don't worry, I'm not at Walmart. And I took a picture of her and in my arms. Nobody understood it until like an hour or two later, because they would say, well, why would he tell us that he's not at Walmart? Yeah. But I think that's what it did to me as a writer. I'm over here, you know, doing all these esoteric, you know, bull crap. And I just want to write love letters to my daughter.
That's right. And maybe that's in some way what Neruda is also encouraging us to consider too. And in fact, you know, that kind of gets me towards, as we point towards the end of the program here, what's one of the things I think about then is how do we come to a place of healing, which obviously the process of healing is in a different time frame for different people. But what are the things that, well, let me ask you this, you know, are there activities or rituals or things that you are doing that kind of help you reconcile what took place and you as an apostle resident?
Well, you know, it goes back to the baby, you know, because I'm really afraid of the future, you know, and I'm not going to be so afraid that I'm not going to, you know, assert, you know, my ideal, you know, contribution to a great future. But I'm afraid of the future for my daughter. She's 5 months old, and you have kids too. And I'm sure this has not, it's not a separate issue, what happened and your children. I'm thinking, I don't want her to grow up in a world where they would, you know, and so I think one of the ways that I've been doing maybe what you're describing is I'm just spending a lot more time with her, a lot more time just looking at her face, interacting with her, and I'm trying to play tug of war with her.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's it. I think it's just, it makes me appreciate my family. It makes me appreciate my friends, and it makes me, you know, and so probably maybe that's it.
A sense of presence.
What about?
Presence. Yeah, the same thing, actually. I would say the same thing on my children a lot, but also just like in sort of not only the children, but just gratitude, so much gratitude for the things that I often take for granted in life.
Like me. Told you, there'd be some humor.
I do take you for granted. I won't lie. But the things I take for granted in life. And I'm also reading, You know, I read poetry. I still read a lot of poetry, Daniel, believe it or not, you know, even though I've been working on prose for years now. But
I believe it. I actually still write poetry.
You are
a poet, a soul poet. I was going to say you are poetic, but that sounds so cheesy. So you're a soul poet.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'll take that. That doesn't sound cheesy. But, you know, one of the people that I read often to the poems, not only his poetry, but also just his writing in general, is Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk who actually has a really good poem that I just wanted to share too as a way to kind of end my part of this. He has a poem called Please Call Me By My True Names, in which the poem is essentially recognizing the kind of interconnectedness that we all share, the thing that we're all one community. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to share the whole poem because it's a pretty long poem, but I do want to just share some of the ideas of the poem. So here it is, Thich Nhat Hanh's Please Call Me By My True Names. Don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today, I am still arriving. Look deeply. Every second I am arriving to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in the stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. I am a mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of a river. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hinds, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to his people. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom. Please call me by my true names. I am all of these, so I can hear all of my cries and laughter all at once, so I can see that my joy and my pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up and the door of my heart be left open, the door of compassion. Nice. And so I've been reading a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm always reading his work, but it's just a good way to sort of contemplate these types of things. I find it helpful in my own healing, and I share these things with my family as well. You know, I think that's the thing, is anything that we find that's helpful to remind us of our own compassion, to remind us of our own humanity is going to be helpful.
You know, my response whenever somebody talks to me from outside of El Paso, or anybody asks me about this, is to write love letters to El Paso, in a sense. And I think one of the memories that keeps coming back to me is when I first moved here. I moved from Fresno, California, not directly via Minnesota, but in Fresno, it was very violent. There's a lot of gang activity. There's a lot of, at one time, Fresno was the murder capital of all of California. But I think ultimately East Palo Alto beat them in the next year, and they were going back and forth. I mean, it was just ridiculous. So I was used to that. When I came to El Paso, a city that's, 80-90% Latino and, very poor, I remember going to Music Under the Stars, this huge gathering in a park on the border between Mexico and the United States on the U.S. side. Thousands and thousands of people, free music. You can bring your beer, you can bring your wine. And I was invited by another faculty member, and I thought, there's going to be a shooting. I know there's going to be a shooting. There's going to be a. I thought I was going to be able to count the fights.
At least a fight, yeah.
We sat next to these cholos. And you know what? All night long, they called me sir.
Yeah, that's so right.
And they
that's
welcomed true. Me to El Paso.
That is so true. That is indicative completely of – that's exactly right. That's one of the first things that blew me away when I first got here is, everywhere I went – From the auto mechanic to the grocery store, people would say, let me help you there, sir, or how are you today, sir? Like just everybody. Yeah, guys with tattoos on their necks and faces. How you doing, sir? Can I help you with that? I'm just like, wow, this is in Fresno because, obviously.
Right. But we love Fresno. I'm Daniel Chacon.
We do. And I am Tim Hernandez.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And
we'll see you next week.